This is a Rabble Podcast Network show.
New voices in your head.
It's radio.
Free
radio.
You're listening to Feminist Current, making waves in the mainstream.
Let me clear space for you to sit beside me. You don't need your back against the wall.
You are listening to Feminist Current. I'm Megan Murphy. It's become increasingly difficult for leftists and feminists to critique certain ideas and groups, even when those groups put forth misogynist ideas, such as far-right Islamic groups. At the same time, we're dealing with figures like Donald Trump and his followers, who are promoting ignorant, dangerous, and racist arguments against Muslims as a group, homogenizing Muslim people in a misinformed and damaging way. Mariam Nemazi wants to set the record straight. An atheist, a leftist, a feminist, a critic of Islamic extremism, and an ex-Muslim, Nemazi is routinely misrepresented and attacked by her opponents, who call her Islamophobic for speaking out against the religious right. I spoke with her over the phone about her positions and the reactions from her critics last week from her home in London. Here is that interview. You know, you've been very vocal about the fact that you've seen the left refusing to be critical of Islam. I wonder if you can talk about some examples of this.
Yeah, I mean, I'm on the left, very much on the left myself. So I find it, I call it basically a politics of betrayal, because I think left politics has always been a banner carrier of social justice, demanding universal rights, equality, secularism, and being very critical of religion, you know. And unfortunately, there is a large segment of the left that refuses to do so. So there are many examples, they're very happy to be critical of Christianity's role, for example, in perpetrating homophobia or misogyny. But when it comes to Islam, you find that many of those very same groups will then end up defending religion and the religious right wing, rather than defending women and people and their rights. So if you'd like a few examples, at Goldsmiths University recently, I had a talk on apostasy, blasphemy, and free expression in the age of ISIS. And I had some Islamic society students, coming and trying to disrupt my talk, laughing when I talked about the beheading of Bangladeshi bloggers, for example, and just constantly trying to create a climate of intimidation and fear. And the video of this sort of the disruptions that they perpetrated, it was on YouTube. It was clear for everyone to see. And then you have the Feminist Society of Goldsmiths and the LGBTQ+ Society of that university siding with the Islamic Society and issuing a statement in solidarity with them. So basically in solidarity with misogynists and homophobes against someone like myself that's a campaigner for women's rights and for gay rights. You know, and there's plenty of examples of that nature where any sort of criticism of Islam and Islamism is seen to be an attack on the Muslim minority, whereas in reality there's dissent within the so-called Muslim minority as well. Many Muslims or ex-Muslims who are free thinkers, who are feminists, who are socialists, they're facing, persecution, intimidation, threats by the religious right wing, the Muslim religious right wing. Nonetheless, people who should be on our side are often siding with them.
Mm-hmm. And you're an ex-Muslim yourself, is that right?
Yeah, I'm someone who was, I suppose, born and raised as a Muslim. I mean, the reality is that depending on the lottery of birth, that's what determines what your religion will most likely be. So if, as someone like myself who's been born in Iran, to Muslim parents who also were born into a religion out of no choice really of their own. So I was born a Muslim, I was raised as a Muslim, but I'm now an ex-Muslim and an atheist.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, you know, the process behind your coming to a critique of Islam and becoming an atheist instead. You know, what happened?
Yeah, I mean, again, my critique is of Islam as a belief system. I think a lot of your listeners will understand the fact that religion is patriarchal, it's misogynist, and for a lot of women, it's, you know, especially because women are very often the first targets of any religion, and, you know, it's something that a lot of women go through, is this sort of criticism of various ideas and beliefs that are misogynist, and religion is one of them. Obviously, with regards to Islam, one of the issues with it is not that it's worse than any other religion. I think you'll find misogyny in all the religious texts, but because it has state power and political power in many instances, a lot of the rules and regulations that are anti-women in the Quran, for example, is part of the law in many places. So for me, I started questioning religion when I actually lived in an Islamic state, when a left-leaning Iranian revolution was expropriated by the Islamist movement. Iran became an Islamic state, a theocracy, and it became very clear to me what religion means when it has access to power. So it'll say women's, you know, women are half worth half that of a man's, but then you find in a theocracy that if you go to court, for example, a woman's testimony is actually worth half that of a man's. You'll find that, you know, homosexuality, for example, is looked down upon in a country where, you know, Sharia is the law of the land, where it is a theocracy. Then it's something that's punishable by death, as is apostasy, you know, unveiling or improper veiling in a country like Iran, which has veiling laws. Veiling is compulsory. There is, you know, if you're improperly veiled, as they call it, or you unveil, it is punishable by fines. It is also an offense that is, you know, you can face prison terms for. And so I think when you live in such a situation, it becomes quite clear what religion means, especially for women, particularly since if you look at any country where Islamists have started to take power, their first line of attack are women. You know, it's the family laws that start to change, the veiling, the physical sort of assault on women and the denial of their rights, particularly in the family, that is the first line of offense. You know, so for me, that was the starting point of questioning religion and its role.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as you've pointed out, a lot of people confuse Muslim with Islam. I wonder if you can clarify the difference.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's in a sense, it's ironic that people who are consider themselves feminist or on the left, sections of them will side with, defend Islam, for example, as a belief system, or they'll defend Islamism, which is, you know, the religious right. It's like the Muslim right. It's similar to the Christian right or the Jewish right or the Hindu right. So they'll end up defending them rather than and see that as a defense of Muslims. And of course, there are distinctions between these. For example, Islam is obviously like Christianity. It's a belief. Islamism, as I mentioned, is like the Christian right or the Hindu right. And Muslims are people. And, you know, you find what's interesting is that Muslims are believers like any other believers, and they're not a homogeneous group. So you'll have different types of Christians. That's clear to everyone. You have Christians who are pro-choice. You'll have Christians who are, you know, pro-gay rights. And then you'll have Christians who think gay people should be killed, and you have Christian right movements that are trying to deny women's reproductive rights, and so on and so forth. So there, when it comes to Christianity, the Christian right, and Christians, these distinctions are clear. And, you know, after all, religion is a lived experience. As I mentioned before, people are born into a religion very often out of no choice of their own. And that lack of choice follows them throughout until the day they die. And so it's very much a lived experience. So you have different types of Muslims, and Muslims who are secularists, who are feminists, who are even atheists, really. They're, you know, cultural Muslims, they would say. And so in that sense, I think when you have the far right blaming all Muslims for Islamism's crime, they sort of homogenize Muslims. But you find that so-called progressives do the same thing. They homogenize Muslims and see Muslims through the eyes of Islamists rather than seeing them as individuals with as many different points of view as any other group of people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Thank you. I wonder if you think feminism has been sufficiently or effectively critical of the particular misogyny that exists in far-right Islamist cultures.
I mean, there's a lot of, obviously, feminists or women's rights campaigners and secularists in you know, the Middle East, North Africa, South Asia, and also in the diaspora, the immigrants, the migrant community. I mean, one of the greatest challenges against the Islamist movement are women. And I think that's one of the reasons, too, why there's such a huge push from the Islamists to control women. I think because they're at the, the receiving end most visibly and first and foremost, that the fight back and push back comes from the women's rights movement as well. So I think if you look at the many, very many examples of women in particular pushing back, fighting back, you know, you have, for example, the unveiling movement in Iran, where women are coming out and removing their veil, even though it's punishable by prison or by fines, by harassment, and so on and so forth. You have in, for example, places like Morocco, you have a movement to eat during Ramadan very often. This is also women who are leading the fight. And you can see that in very various ways. In Algeria, you have a movement called 20 Years is Enough, and it's against the family Sharia family laws and saying, you know, enough is enough. We want our equal rights. So I think you do see that very often. Unfortunately, you have sections of feminists in the left, who consider feminism a sort of Western concept, and they think that, that there are no women's rights campaigners or demands for equality in the Middle East or North Africa or amongst minority communities. That's not true, first off. And second of all, it's primarily because they've got this sort of culturally relativist viewpoint. They think that, you know, the sort of oppression and repression of women is part of their culture. And they're actually feeding into what the religious right is saying. It's our culture, therefore we can oppress and suppress women. And in a sense, you find progressives repeating that line. Of course, that's not to say that all feminists or all secularists or all leftists think that way. But I think quite a large segment do. And it is quite frustrating for women's rights campaigners, both in the regions as well as, in immigrant communities here in the West, with the lack of support that they receive from many sort of mainstream feminists and leftists.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, after the mass assaults that happened in Cologne on New Year's Eve, there was a relatively widespread argument made in the West, primarily, that somehow feminists or progressives were afraid to name the perpetrators and to label these attacks as cultural, as opposed to just being yet another case of male violence against women. And many wanted, for example, to blame what they called refugees for the attacks. I wonder what your perspective is on these arguments and, on what happened in Cologne that night.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Cologne, Mariama Hella Lucas has written a really great article. She is the founder of Women Living Under Muslim Laws, and she's also founded Secularism as a Women's Issue, and she's written about it. And I think it's the best piece on what happened in Cologne. And I recommend that everyone should read it if they can. But basically, what she says and what I agree with as well is the fact that, you know, the attacks in Cologne are something that's happened to women in the Middle East and North Africa for a long time. For example, we all know about the mass sex assaults in Tahrir Square in Egypt as a way of, organized way of pushing women out of the public space and, you know, punishing women for being vocal in the Egyptian Revolution. There's instances in Algeria where this has happened as well. And, you know, one of the things she says is that this is not a new phenomenon. It's very much part of the sort of Islamist pushback against women in the public space. And I think if we look at the fact that we see terrorism, for example, is something that is happening extensively in the Middle East and North Africa and South Asia, you know, there's not a week that goes by without people being killed via terrorist attacks. And then we see the effects here in Europe as well, or in the West with, you know, the bombings in New York, in Bali, in London, in Paris, and so on and so forth. So again, it's part of this sort of Islamist movement and its effects on people's lives, whether it's via terrorism, whether it is an attack on women's rights and their right to be out and about in the public space. So I think we need to look at these attacks very much as part of that movement's, you know, influence in Europe, and as we would see the influence of Sharia law or terrorism as well. You know, like we have Sharia courts here in Britain and other places in Europe. So I think that it's not a normal sort of attack on women in the same way that honor crimes and domestic violence, well, they're both violence against women, but they're very different in their nature. And, you know, the fact that it is a sort of group violence against women. Again, I think that we need to look at it this way and challenge Islamism primarily as a way of defending women's rights. I mean, to blame refugees is, you know, I think doesn't make sense, because when perpetrators, even if it is a group of perpetrators, they need to be held accountable. But we can't blame all migrants, obviously, for these acts. And I think, unfortunately, because of the sort of conflation between, you know, whole groups of people with a criticism of Islam and Islamism, we're finding that there was silence on this issue for a while. It took a while for the information to go out. And still, I think quite a number of people haven't been prosecuted for these crimes. So I think we need to start looking at it differently and also treat you know, those who are criminals as criminals, prosecute them irrespective of their race, religion, nationality, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and I think that some feminists were concerned about maybe coming off as blaming Islam for these attacks and letting, you know, German men or European men off. You know, they wanted to call these attacks male violence instead of a result of something cultural. And in that, maybe some critiques that needed to be brought forward and acknowledged were lost and all that?
Yeah, I mean, I think the reality is that women are more important than culture and religion and what have you, and our primary response and first response has to be defending women who are facing violence in that manner, you know. So I think the concerns must be secondary in the sense, you know, we have to speak out against violence against women in any form and shape that it takes, and be very clear that it's not to be tolerated. You know, on the issue of culture, I mean, again, I think culture isn't homogenous. You have, you know, culture is not static, it's changing, and you have different cultural practices within so-called communities as well. You know, not everybody in the West represents enlightenment values. Not every migrant or Muslim represents Sharia or misogynist values, you know. So I think in that sense, it's important to hold the perpetrators to account. And I think it's important to also see the links with Islamism in particular. You know, this is the, in a sense, Islamist culture that is being enforced, whether it's via terrorism or whether it's via violence against women and trying to push women out of the public space.
And, you know, there has been some controversy over Charlie Hebdo's satire and the Western response to the attacks in Paris. Some people have called the comics racist or misogynist, and others say that that people who are living outside Paris and who are being critical in this way just don't understand the context for Charlie Hebdo's politics. And I wonder if you think the Western left's response to the Paris attacks and to the kind of satire and political commentary brought forth by Charlie Hebdo has been misguided in any way.
Well, I mean, irrespective of whether we understand the context or not, let's just say for a second that we don't. Do people actually think that, cartoonists should be murdered for what they've drawn? And I think clearly the answer is no. There is no context and no justification for the murder of people merely for drawing cartoons, whether you think Charlie Hebdo's racist, whether you think they're not. I think, you know, that should be a very clear-cut issue. The fact that it isn't says a lot about the world that we live in. You know, the fact that there are all these people, particularly people who are consider themselves progressive, you know, on the left, who consider themselves feminists, who are constantly justifying the Islamist movement and its murder of cartoonists, its murder of women, and its attack on women, and so on and so forth. And, you know, seeing these attacks as people's right to religion and, in a cultural relativist sort of point of view. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, there are people in the Middle East and North Africa who are in prison, who are executed for drawing cartoons, for speaking out, for criticizing Islam and the Islamist movement. And, you know, Charlie Hebdo is one of many examples of this sort of violence against free thinkers, against secularists, against cartoonists, against women, against religious minorities, and so on and so forth, apostates. So I think if you look at it within the broader context, you know, Charlie Hebdo is one example of countless examples where the Islamists have killed people. I mean, music is banned in Mali. Women are not allowed to sing in Iran. Women are not allowed to, go out without a male guardian in Saudi Arabia. I mean, I think we need to look at all of this within a context. And free thinkers in particular, you have Bangladeshi bloggers being hacked to death because of things they've written on their blogs. You have Raif Badawi, who has been sentenced to 10 years in prison in Saudi Arabia for, you know, just raising the issue of religion and politics. He's been sentenced to 1,000 lashes. For example, you've got someone like Fatima Naoud. She's a poet in Egypt. She's been sentenced now to 3 years in prison for being critical. She's been seen to insult Islam, as the Charlie Hebdo cartoonists were seen to be done. And all she did was criticize, you know, animal slaughter in Islam, Islam's animal slaughter. So, first of all, we need to see it within the larger context. Second of all, we need to, you know, from my perspective, I mean, and I think the reality of it is that Charlie Hebdo is a left-wing, anti-racist magazine, and it's an anti-clerical one. You know, it criticizes Christianity, criticizes the National Front and the fascists in Europe, as well as the government. And actually, its criticisms of Islam is a very small aspect of the criticism that it's done. I think, you know, I think they did a study on how many cartoons it's had on Christianity and how many in Islam, and the ones on Christianity are a lot more. But I think, you know, for us, I mean, the issue is, can religion be criticized? Of course it can. Must it be criticized? I think, of course, it must. I think a lot of progress in the world is as a result of criticism, and particularly criticism of religion. And when you look at the fact that You know, Islam is in political power. It is wreaking havoc across the world. It is denying women's rights. It is actually executing apostates, executing gay people. And it's not just the Islamic State that's doing it. It's the Iranian regime that's doing it, the Saudi regime that's doing it. You've got people being executed in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in, Bangladesh, and on, Pakistan, and on. So in that sense, I think when we look at Charlie Hebdo, we need to say, one, well, you know, there shouldn't even be a question that people should be able to draw what they want, even if you don't like it, even if you're offended by it. And two, actually, we do need to criticize and even offend, you know, when criticism of religion is punishable by death. You know, when you have blasphemy laws and apostasy laws, then the most sane reaction is to blaspheme and to apostatize as a way of resisting and refusing. It's sort of like gay people coming out when they're being discriminated and imprisoned for being gay, women coming out and demanding reproductive rights when they're denied it. It's very much the same in this situation. So Charlie Hebdo, for me, are people who actually are standing, you know, alongside those of us from the Middle East, North Africa, and South Asia, who are dealing with many of these issues, rather than excusing and tolerating and censoring themselves or promoting censorship when actually a fight back is taking place and solidarity is hugely needed.
And, you know, you've been attacked in a number of ways because of your criticisms of Islam. You've been no-platformed. Recently, Warwick University Student Union tried to no-platform you, for example. I know you're accused of Islamophobia all the time. I wonder if you think that these attacks on you are part of a larger and maybe newer political trend from the progressive left and or even in feminism.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we are seeing a change in things. I think, you know, censorship has become progressive now, you know. Trying to stop anyone from offending has become something that is seen to be progressive. Safe spaces, defending the safe spaces, even of misogynists, is seen to be progressive. And so I think Kenan Malik's, you know, the British author, says it very well. He says that no one says that they're pro-censorship, but they'll say, I'm for free expression, but, and there's a lot that follows the but, you know, not if it's offensive, not if it's Islamophobic, not if it's, you know, discriminatory against minorities. And again, criticism of religion is seen to be discrimination against believers, which is absurd when you think about it. And so I think it is, we are seeing a trend towards more restrictions on free expression. And the reality is that free expression is the only thing that many of us have in order to dissent and to refuse and resist. And so, you know, it is a fight that's taking place and one that I think we're finding a lot more.
And, you know, finally, how can leftists and feminists in particular stand in solidarity with and support and work alongside women and those who are working to challenge and confront the extreme misogyny that's happening in Islam?
I think, it's solidarity is key here. You know, the problem is that we live in a world now where identity politics reigns supreme, and people feel that in order to show solidarity, they have to show solidarity with an identity, which is usually either a religious identity, a cultural identity, rather than, political goals and ideals. In the past, we fought together, irrespective of, you know, our color, our ethnicity, our beliefs, for political goals, you know, for women's rights and equality, for an end to segregation and racial you know, apartheid and so on and so forth. Now, that solidarity around political ideals of universal rights and equality and secularism doesn't exist anymore. And that's why we're finding so many people aligning with the religious right, because there seem to be the identity, defending the identity of Muslims, you know. So I think we do need to go back to basics and show solidarity with political and social movements that are demanding change, you know, and there's lots and lots of groups and organizations that are working towards real change in the Middle East, in North Africa, in South Asia, and also amongst immigrant communities here in the West, against FGM, for example, against honor killings and crimes, against Sharia courts, not from, obviously, you know, the far-right perspective, which hates all immigrants, refugees, Muslims, and targets Sharia courts or, you know, misogynist practices because it really wants to scapegoat Muslims and immigrants. But there are lots of people from immigrant and Muslim backgrounds who are challenging, you know, misogyny, and that can and should be supported based on, you know, the sort of ideals that we fought for in the past, rather than on regressive identity politics.
Great. Again, thank you so much for talking with me today. I've learned so much from you, and thank you so much for all you do.
Thank you very much.
Okay. You just heard an interview with Mariam Namazi, human rights activist and co-founder of the British Council of Ex-Muslims. For more on her work, visit mariamnamazi.com. That is all the time we have for today. I'm Megan Murphy. Thanks for tuning in to Feminist Current. Feminist Current is a syndicated show produced by Megan Murphy out of Vancouver, BC, Canada. For more information on the show, please visit www.feministcurrent.com. If your station would like to air Feminist Current, you can find episodes at audioport.org or email us at info@feministcurrent.com.